Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It's not unusual today to see young kids playing with iPads, iPhones, and all kinds of touchscreen devices. The harried parent might be grateful for the distraction, but there's an underlying question. What's all this screen time doing to these young developing brains? Joining me here in the studio to talk about toddlers and technology, Lisa Guernsey at the New America Foundation. Joining me from the studio in San Francisco, Ben Worthen of the Wall Street Journal, and Liz Pearl of Common Sense Media, and by phone from Madison, Wisconsin, Heather Kerkorian. She's an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin. I'm sure many of you will want to weigh in. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be
here. Good morning.
Ben, let me start with you. In yesterday's Wall Street Journal, you had a piece titled, What Happens When Toddlers Zone Out with an iPad? Tell us a little about why you decided to write about this.
Yeah, well, I have two small children, a son who's now four, and when he was 2.5, he and I went on a plane trip together, and I was very afraid of what was going to happen. He was going to freak out or so forth on the plane. So I borrowed an iPad, and I loaded it up with, you know, games and drawing apps and little shows for him, handed it to him when we got in the air, and for 5 hours, he just stood there, sat there transfixed by, you know, the different things that he could do. And when we got off the plane, it pretty much sums up still my feelings about this device. I thought, you know, this was amazing. What happened? And it wasn't just the fact that I was able to sit on a plane and work and read for the first time and since he was born. But, you know, there was something that could actually contain him and hold his attention for 5 hours straight. So it wasn't until a year later that we actually bought an iPad for ourselves and we gave it to him. And right away, his interest in letters and words picked up, I believe, as a result of the word and letter games that he played. He would do these puzzles as well. But my wife and I noticed something else, which was that it seemed to make him whiny. Again, this isn't something that we have a real measure of, but it was really what we perceived. And taking it away from him became a real challenge to the point where it was just a struggle. Sometimes I'd even have to put my hands on it and go back and forth with a little four-year-old at that point trying to pull it away. So I really wanted to find out what was happening. You know, he'd go into this state where you'd call his name and he wouldn't respond to it, or you could snap your fingers in front of his face. And what is that?
He was kind of in a trance?
It seemed that way, yeah. You know, you could do whatever you wanted. He had no idea what was going on around him.
Interesting.
So we didn't know what that was, and I was trying to find out what was happening, and so I just began to look into the topic, and the first thing I really learned is that there's no research on what happens to a little kid when they use a touchscreen device like an iPad.
Ben Worthen, he's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Turning to you now, Lisa Guernsey, you've written a book titled Screen Time, How Electronic Media, From Baby Videos to Educational Software, affects your young child. So would you say that Ben's little boy, that his experience was sort of normal?
I think so. And as a mother of two young ones, especially quite young when I was writing the first edition of that book, I really relate to what Ben's describing there. I will say that we need to get to a place in research where we can make a distinction between kind of zoning out and in a trance and actual kind of engagement, because we may be finding that what's happening is that young children, they may seem to us on the outside world to be kind of zombies, but actually there's a lot of activity going on in their brains. There's a lot that they're working through as they're using these devices. But the content of them may be a really big driver of that, and we have to make some distinctions between what these young children are seeing and playing with when they're using them, and we haven't done anywhere near the number of studies that need to be done to get at that question yet.
Is there any indication that for these young toddlers who use these devices that they may learn letters or numbers or identify places more quickly?
Certainly, there's not any peer-reviewed research that would lead us to that conclusion for very young children, for say, toddlers up to age 3. But what we are seeing are some small studies that are trying to get at different types of learning. And if there's a difference, for instance, between being able to learn from passive video versus interactive video on a touchscreen environment versus a face-to-face interaction with somebody. And one study that just came out of the Georgetown University looked at that question with 2.5-year-olds and 3-year-olds and found that the interactive environment and the face-to-face environment did lead to some learning, some ability to kind of transfer what was learned on the screen to a real-world situation.
Interesting.
But not in a passive video environment.
And now, turning to you, Liz Pearl, as editor-in-chief of Common Sense Media, I gather your organization did a study not too long ago on the number of toddlers and very young children who are using these devices. How large a number are we talking about?
Well, you're talking about even 6 months ago when we did the study, you know, it's moving at warp speed. But even then, more than half of kids 0 to 8 had access to, it's not necessarily an iPad. It could be, you know, an iPhone when it's not a great teething device. I've seen that in an airport, too. So this is really the environment our kids are growing up in.
So everybody is using it, is what you're saying, in various ways.
Yeah, I mean, there are socioeconomic differences. But yes, it's the smartphone and the tablet is entering schools in places where people don't have them at homes. And it's happening so fast.
And now turning to you, Heather Kerkorian, I know that as we've already heard, lots of parents and their young children are using these devices. So is there any research underway?
Well, that's a really great question. And as others have alluded to, there's really no research at all to go on. So we know from things like the Common Sense Media Report how often kids are using these devices and what kinds of things they're doing. But we know virtually nothing about the potential impact of these touchscreen devices, either for good or ill. So we don't know if they're educationally valuable, and we don't know if they can cause any harm.
Do you have any sense of the difference between what happens when a very young child watches television versus interacting with one of these devices?
Sure. So we don't know a whole lot about things like what's going on in the brain when they're using these kinds of devices. We know a lot about what kids are doing mentally when they're watching television. And at least by 2 or 2.5 years of age, kids are very cognitively active when they're watching TV. So they're making a lot of inferences. They're processing the information. They're learning information, whether that's good or bad information. That depends on the content. But a lot of that will depend on the context in which they're watching and the types of things that they're watching in terms of determining the impact. But for touchscreen devices, we have very little information. We can guess that perhaps they're even more cognitively active because they have some control over that environment, and that might be particularly useful for very young kids, kids before 2.5 or 3 years of age. But again, there's no research, so we really don't know what's going on yet.
Is a child who's watching television likely to look away more frequently than a child who's using one of these devices, Heather?
That's another really good question. So we know that from infancy up to adulthood, we look at and away from the TV screen very often when we're watching, and we're usually not aware of it because we look away for very short periods of time. But we do look away very often. For touch screens, we have no idea. And again, we can guess that perhaps kids are more engaged when they have control over that interaction. And they might continue to look at the screen for longer periods of time, but that's something that we just don't know for sure yet.
So, Lisa, when you watch young children looking at television or looking at an iPad, what differences do you see?
Well, it really depends on the age of the child, and that's one of the things that I think is so tricky for parents. So, you know, kids grow really fast, and so at 2 years of age, they might be doing something very different than they are at three. Just anecdotally right now, and I think this is really most of what we have to go on, we are finding that children really like the seamless kind of interactivity of the touchscreen devices. It's easier for them to engage with what's happening on the screen. There had been attempts to kind of study how very young children interact with computers in the past, but the barrier was always the fact that they had to learn how to use a mouse or figure out a joystick, and there were these kind of physical motor skill problems that were always clouding what we could really find out.
Now all they have to do is touch.
Exactly. Now that has really been erased, and so we're at a very momentous time where there's a lot we could maybe learn about what children are capable of because those physical barriers are gone. But at the same time, we can't forget that the interaction that they're having with parents is so important.
Lisa Guernsey, Director of Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation, author of a book titled Screen Time, How Electronic Media, From Baby Videos to Educational Software, Affects Your Young Child. If you've just joined us, we're talking about very young children and their interactivity, if that's what it can be called, at very young ages with mobile devices. We're talking about phones and iPads and Androids and all those many, many devices that are out there and available not only to parents but to children. Here's an email from Brian who says, my son is almost two. We have a cast-off iPhone we've given him with a handful of interactive games on it. He now navigates the phone, plays games without help from us. He's become quite proficient at memory and matching games, simple puzzles, and others. His phone is a privilege. We trade off between that and playing with blocks and other non-electronic toys. I think the phone is a great learning tool for him and a godsend for his mother and me. Ben Worthen, what's been your experience since that first exposure?
Yeah, well, we had some similar experiences as well to that parent who wrote in. You know, my son, again, he would do these puzzle apps and he'd do these word games. But, you know, we ended up actually taking the iPad away from him, largely because, you know, this example, this thing we were talking about zoning out. Now, he would do that, and my wife and I would stare at him and think, oh, my God, his brain is going to turn to mush and come oozing out of his ears. And it concerned us a bit. I've subsequently learned that people have pointed out to me, like, well, what does he do when he's playing with his Legos or painting? And we go, well, yes, he zones out and is unresponsive, but we look at him and we think that we're the greatest parents ever because we have an, you know, enterprising young kid who can play with Legos forever. What I've learned is that there's some subtle differences. When he's building a Lego structure, he's in control of the experience. He decides when it ends. He decides when something is good, whereas an app on the iPad will dictate for him when he's completed a level or when he's accomplished something correctly. But it's by no means clear how that difference has, if any, impact on a kid. One of the things that's fascinating to me as a parent about the iPad is that, you know, it's not a TV, but you can watch a TV show. It's not a video game, but you can play video games on it. It's not a puzzle, but you can do a puzzle app. I mean, what's the difference between doing a puzzle app and doing a puzzle in real life or reading a book and reading a book on the iPad?
So, Liz Pearl, how would you answer that question? What is the difference between a video app and, say, Legos or doing a puzzle?
Well, kids have five senses, last time I clocked in. And kids are also zero-sum entities. So there's always the opportunity cost of what they're not doing when they're doing something else. And the greatest touchscreen in the world is an adult face in the world of a child. But it doesn't mean that there isn't a place for screen media. I mean, I think that Lisa alluded to it earlier. It's what's on the screen. So you can be playing a completely mindless video game, or you can be playing one that stimulates parts of the brain that allows for word development or school readiness. Now, the studies haven't shown definitively that those things happen with very young kids yet. And I think we all as parents have to be a little on the alert for the baby Einstein parts of our own psyches that want to believe that if we hand our child something, they're going to end up in first grade when they're four. But, you know, we don't have the research that says touch Legos are different. What we do know is that the child is in charge of the narrative when they're doing their Legos or imaginary games or whatever, playing with their dolls or stuffed animals. And the narrative is embedded oftentimes in the screen and contained for you.
But, you know, I think of from our own children's childhood, the most important toy of all were simple blocks. And so one would wonder, Heather, whether there's any difference in how brains develop if a child is playing with an iPad or playing with blocks.
Yeah, that's a question that's still debated pretty heavily, and with a lack of research, it's hard to answer definitively. So there are some who argue that when children manipulate a 3D object like a block, that stimulates parts of the brain that are otherwise unstimulated and therefore underdeveloped if kids are watching screens or interacting with screens. There are people who claim that, but there's very little research, if any, to actually support that idea. So I don't think there's any expert who would suggest that kids only play with screens or only look at screens, because there are a whole world of experiences they should be having. But whether the brain will actually develop differently or cognitive skills will develop differently because they're doing, as Ben said, a puzzle on a touchscreen versus a three-dimensional puzzle with real pieces, that's really unclear. We just don't know.
So all we can do, Lisa, is watch and see, watch and wait until that child grows a bit older.
Yes, and I found that it helps to have a framework for how to think about this. When I was working on my book, I wanted to provide some advice to myself as a parent who's struggling, but also to others. And so I came up with the three C's, which is based on decades of research on video interactions with young children, but also applies very much to the interactive world as well. And the three C's are to pay attention to content, pay attention to the context of the situation. There's a real difference between a joint engagement, a book reading activity, a mom and a child together, talking about what's on the pages of that book, whether it's electronic or not, versus a child who's alone with that material and not having that engagement. And then the third C is the child, him or herself, the individual child. And this is why it's so tricky, because you have special needs children, you have children of different ages, you have children growing up in very different households with or without a lot of options for playing outside or playing with blocks or having access to adults who can engage them in new ways. So we can't be monolithic in the way we think about what this interactive media is going to mean to children. We really need parents and educators to be thinking about the three C's as they make choices.
And of course, many of today's parents grew up with these video games. Ben, does that include you?
I grew up in that era where first the Atari and then the Nintendos were coming into households. I didn't personally have those in my house. I would always try to play them every time I'd go to a friend's house, but frankly, I was terrible at them. I guess I would just say that one of the things that seems complicated to me going through these decisions that Lisa was outlining as a parent is that, I don't necessarily know what the difference is between reading a book and reading a book on the iPad to my kid. I wouldn't have thought there was any difference in talking to some people who are looking into this or beginning to look into this. There is a question about, is a kid, when they're touching something, are they learning the content that's in the book, or are they learning, what you press and what happens when you press certain things? And it's not necessarily that one is good and one is bad, but that they may in fact be different. And if they're different, as a parent, I'd want to, I'd try to understand the difference between, giving my son to eat a Twinkie and giving him an apple. It's not necessarily that he shouldn't ever have dessert, but, I don't think I want to be giving him dessert for dinner.
But is that a fair comparison, Heather?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Is there a fair comparison between a Twinkie and an apple for dessert?
that's a good question. People's opinions vary widely on this. I tend to be a glass half full sort of person who would like to say there's no evidence at all suggesting that these devices are harmful, whereas Twinkies, we might have some research suggesting that we definitely don't want to have those every day for dinner. But I think, and Lisa certainly alluded to this, that, and as I said before, no expert would say screens should be used solely as the only activity. Obviously, parent-child interaction is extremely important, playing outdoors, being physically active, playing with objects and toys. But I don't think it's a fair comparison yet to say that screens are somehow, especially interactive touch screens, are somehow less good or more harmful than some kind of 3D toy that
you're playing with. All right. I'm going to open the phones. We've got lots of callers waiting. First to Sarah in Brentwood, New York. Good morning to you.
Hello?
Sarah, go right ahead.
Hi, Diane. I'm a big fan. I'm so excited to be able to talk to you on this subject. I'm calling as a former elementary school teacher, as a current literacy consultant, and as a parent of a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. My concern is that when I was in a classroom, I always wanted to teach my students to self-discipline themselves, because as adults, we don't always have a toy being bought for us or an iPad being given to us when we're misbehaving. And I think sometimes, as your guest mentioned about the 5-hour plane ride, that when parents, and I see this often, when parents are trying to quell their children or discipline their children by either giving them an iPad or taking away an iPad as a consequence, I'm not sure that we're really teaching young children how to behave in certain situations without a carrot being dangled in front of them. And additionally, my son, who's now in kindergarten, knows how to, he's ahead in his reading and ahead in his writing, and he had none of these devices growing up. I am certain that that is because I read to him every night. We shared experiences, we shared discussions, and he understands the power of holding something in his hands, of reading it, of feeling it, and then putting it on his shelf as it's completed, as something that he has been able to read himself. And I'm just concerned that as kids get these devices more in their hands, they're becoming less connected to other children, their family, their teachers, and things like that.
And less likely or less able to self-stimulate, for example, Lisa?
I think this is a really, really important question, because what we're getting at right now is self-regulation in young children, and it is not developed when they are born. It is certainly not developed when they're two, and it's not there when they're four. And I have elementary school children, and it's not developed yet, even often with them, right? Many adults. We need to help children learn how to occupy themselves, to focus on what they're working on, to know how to follow through on things. And we have not yet grappled with this when it comes to the media environment that children are in. So some of it parents are working through by limit setting, by having ideas around, well, we're going to use this device in this context, but it's at bedtime, it's off. There's going to be all sorts of ways we need to kind of deal with the self-regulation issue.
Lisa Guernsey, Director of Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email on exactly that point, Lisa. It's from Jerry in Cleveland, Ohio, who says, our kids are 8 and 9. They've never owned electronic games, toys, iPods, iPads, and never will. Too many of our friends' kids are fixated on electronics to the exclusion of anything else, including reading and play. They complain about it, saying so-and-so has a Nintendo. My answer is always, so-and-so is not my child. You are. And if they were, they wouldn't have it. Their only computer time at home is for school or educational games, which are a treat for them. I spend all day at the computer for work, have a smartphone, and know firsthand how hard it is to tear myself away from them to interact with actual people. Some of their classmates have cell phones. Liz Pearl, what do you make of that?
Well, it's something we hear all the time. And if you hearken back to the days when it was just purely TV and content consumption, one of the things we did at Common Sense Media is we realized that you can't cover kids' eyes. Our job is to help, as parents, as Common Sense Media, we help parents and teachers help kids to see. And there's a corollary here on the self-regulation issue. If every time you hand your child an iPad in a restaurant, they're going to make the correlation that, oh, before the burger comes, I'm going to be amused and I don't have the opportunity to engage. But I think that what Jerry might consider is the fact that these iPads, and maybe not in two-year-olds, but as they progress, these forms of communication teach 21st century skills, and they're going to be distant learning, communication, collaboration skills that are going to be required for successful young adults. How we calibrate when we introduce these skills, and again, the self-regulation thing is absolutely key. I've never seen a two-year-old with an off switch. My 18-year-old still doesn't have one. You know, we just have to help kids learn to regulate themselves. We teach them that about their emotions. We try and teach them that about media consumption and to be media literate. We're going to have to teach children, as an essential part of parenting and education, how to use these very powerful tools in a right time, right place, right manner.
All right. To Birmingham, Alabama. Epsy, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I just have a question on this subject. I find that iPads, iPods, laptops, you know, we all have them in our house. I have teens and preteens, and it just seems very isolating. You know, we could all be in the same room together, but everybody will be plugged in to some device, and it's like we're all in a separate world. And we've made a big effort to tell the kids that, you know, now is not the time. We're doing this. We're not doing that. And have there been any effects shown from this that it, you know?
You know, it's such a good question and takes me back to television when people would sit around fixated on the television, not really communicating, but being there around that TV set. Are these devices different, Lisa?
Well, I think that there's a lot we have to untangle here, because people get very concerned about the substitution effect, the idea that this interaction with this device or with the old-fashioned TV is substituting for face-to-face time. But what we don't always have are studies that confirm that to be the case, because it may be that there are children who, in the absence of TV or in the absence of an interactive game, don't necessarily have someone there who's, you know, going to give them a really rich back-and-forth interaction or sit on the floor with them and play blocks.
Lisa Guernsey, she's Director of Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation. More on isolation and the application of these devices when it's good, when maybe it's not so good, when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
This month's Reader's Review, Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson. A day laborer in Idaho experiences the wonder and heartbreak of America's industrial awakening. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're talking about young children, the use of electronic devices, iPads, iPhones. And here's a caller in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Gawley, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks, Diane. I just wanted to raise the issue of the radiation from the cell phones and other wireless devices being, you know, put in cribs and handed to small children. I think there's, you know, a serious potential danger there. There's been a lot of controversy about it, even though the National Cancer Institute, you know, said in July 2001 that there wasn't actually a risk. A lot of people have called that study into question, and the World Health Organization is very concerned about it. putting it in the same category as auto exhaust, and as a, you know, potential cancer causing.
Interesting. Heather Kerkorian, Dr. Gawley's question regarding radiation, and then we have an email concerned about the long-term effect on a child's eyes. What are your thoughts?
So in terms of radiation, my expertise isn't medical science, but my understanding of the research is that that's still very controversial and that there's no solid, rigorous scientific evidence suggesting harm. That said, I don't think any expert would criticize a parent for choosing not to use these devices with their small children out of that concern. I certainly advocate for a cautious approach if that's a concern that parents have. And in terms of eye damage, it turns out with television, that's something that our parents always told us.
Sure.
Since the 50s or 60s, that hasn't really been a concern. So while television screens did emit some low-level radiation when they were first on the market for the public, that hasn't actually been true for many decades.
Interesting.
And in fact, often parents think it's harmful for their kids to have screens close to their faces because, of course, as adults, if we had screens that close to our faces, it would strain our eyes because we'd have to be cross-eyed in order to focus. But actually, for very small children, their ideal focal distance is much closer to their faces. So that's why they tend to sit so close to screens.
I see.
So it's not actually harmful for their eyes as it would be for an adult.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Gawley, for your call. Here's a fascinating email from Syria, who is in Conroe, Texas. She says, my son is 4 and autistic. We've seen vast improvement with his language skills since we've given him a tablet with appropriate apps. While the research is yet to be done on the issue with small children, I've spoken with my son's teachers regarding my concerns about the time he uses it. His speech teacher has told me she encourages such use because it stimulates his brain in a way that seems to be beneficial to his speech and language skills. I'm concerned he'll miss out on social interaction, which he needs more than most children, in order to develop skills he needs to develop. Does your panel have a comment on the trade-off effect? Lisa?
Well, I looked into autism and technology and some of those connections in my book, and there's, I think, a lot more that's come out since writing about it. We are seeing anecdotal evidence that autistic preschoolers really are engaged very deeply with these interactive technologies, and that perhaps the ability to not have to focus on a person's face, which can be kind of confusing and out of some of their developmental range, means that they have the ability to connect more with the content. There was also a very interesting study out of the UK that looked at Thomas the Tank Engine as a TV show where there were trains that had faces that showed facial expressions, and autistic children often learned about facial expressions through that show more than they were learning from face-to-face interaction. All these are just fascinating points, and I think there's a lot we don't know on this, and I would just encourage anyone out there who's in autism research to keep us all posted on what the effects of technology.
Well, that's really fascinating. Liz Pearl, any thoughts on that?
I remember that Thomas the Tank Engine study, and it was really eye-opening. These technologies have such promise for kids with special needs. You know, again, common sense, not all or nothing. But for the first time, there are programs that help kids interact without the frustrations that they have that act as static in trying to incorporate information the way a different brain might do so. Dyslexia, learning issues, there are so many promising developments in these very individualized programs that can be done with kids. Again, scaffolded, they need a teacher, special ed person to do it, because they're not going to learn necessarily on their own. But boy, this is really where the promise of individual education that can is subtly embedded into these technologies.
You know,
really
I'm wondering also about older children who might be autistic, and whether there has been any view that they could be helped by use of these devices, Liz.
Well, they already are. You see in colleges, for instance, I mean, in the old days when laptops were like steamer trunks, kids were allowed to bring in laptops for people with auditory processing issues, for instance. And now there's one wonderful young man that I actually have speak to parents for me from UC Santa Cruz who's developed an entire system. He can't process auditorily, but he has developed an entire system on his own using all these different apps to take down notes, to reprocess them, to collect with other kids and crowdsource information, and then return it in a way that's meaningful and useful that clearly shows he's getting learning that he wouldn't have otherwise.
Very interesting. All right, let's go to Melvin Village, New Hampshire. Richard has another view. Good morning to you, sir.
Hi, Diane. How are you? It's
fine, thank you.
My concern, listening to your calls, it is a great tool. All these things are great tools. All these devices are great if you use them as a tool. But when you use them for play and all kids want to have them, I think it takes away from a kid's memories as a child, as I was a child. We used sticks, and we built huts, and we played with the kids in the neighborhood. And we did all these things that you're outdoors. Kids don't go outdoors anymore. They play with these games, and everybody's got a cell phone stuck to their head, even the little kids at bus stops. I just think these are tools. They're not toys, and that's basically my point.
Ben Worthen, has the use of this device at all affected your little boy's desire to go out and play?
Well, getting him away from the device when he's actually using it, yeah, he doesn't really want to do anything at that point. But, you know, he loves to go outside. We play outside all the time. He will, you know, do other stuff. Kids like to do things, you know, and if you give them an iPad, they like to do an iPad. If you give them blocks, they probably like to do blocks. I think it's a great point, though, that this is a tool and that we need to use it as a tool, and it's something that I am trying to become better at as a parent, making, you know, better, just instead of just saying, wow, I need to make dinner and change the baby's diaper and take a shower here, play with the iPad, trying to figure out, just think for a second about what it means when I give my son an iPad and make at least a partially informed decision as opposed to just giving it to him. But one of the things that I also want to make sure that I get nervous about myself is that, you know, I didn't grow up with an iPad. They didn't exist, you know, when I was a kid, let alone, you know, 2 years ago. I don't want to be afraid of the new thing. And I don't want to deprive him of an experience, like Liz was saying, that is going to be an important part of growing up in the modern world, you know, having have these types of skills. And so, you know, I don't want to make the mistake of not teaching my kid to read because they just invented the printing press and I'm afraid what it's going to do.
Interesting, Lisa.
Yeah, I think that really resonates with me. There was a really interesting study that I found when I was working on my book, and it was about how parents viewed media and what that meant to the way children then learned from media, because it's all tangled up, right? The way that we model our behavior of how we see media, and then that is going to have an influence on what they learn from it. So this one study, it was from the 70s, actually, and it was in Israel, and it was comparing American children who had color TV versus children in Israel who had just black and white TV. And the question was, you know, is just the black and white TV, it's just maybe not as engaging for them. They're probably not learning as much. But the actual result was the opposite. In fact, the Israeli children were learning much more from the black and white TV. And what the researcher profound was that the parents saw TV in Israel as an information device, as something that they needed to stay connected, whereas the parents in the United States saw TV, even in color, right, as entertainment and veg out time. And it changed the way children related to what they were experiencing. And I think that that's something we have to, you know,
be
thinking about.
And to Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, Colin.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to make a comment that I actually grew up as a, I'm a millennial, just to start. And I grew up with the internet and high-speed internet and Facebook beyond that. And I even took a class as a first and second grader on how to create a web page and use the internet. And I can definitely say that technology and these new technologies have shaped me and made me a successful person now. I now have a job, which I know many people in my generation struggle for. And I really credit a lot of this technology to have helped me along the way. So, and I also grew up playing sports and playing outside. And, I wasn't just stuck inside playing my Sega Genesis when I was a kid, even though that was something that I did. And I do have great memories doing that as well. But I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, millennials especially, I think, are a good example of how we've kind of developed with this technology.
That's very interesting. Heather Kerkorian, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think that experience is pretty representative for what young people today think about their own experiences with technology. And we've addressed this a little bit earlier, that the world is just changing, the world in which kids are growing up and the world in which young people will have to become productive members of society. So being able to learn how to navigate these technologies early on is becoming increasingly important. And also the idea that these technologies are somehow replacing more traditional activities or outdoor play, that's a little bit misguided. The research actually suggests that at least the youngest kids today spend just as much time outdoors as they spend with screen media. So it's sort of a natural reaction for us to shy away from newer technologies and to assume they're somehow less valuable and that they're somehow displacing things that we did when we were kids. But the research suggests that's not necessarily the case. They're certainly being incorporated into existing activities, and there are certainly kids who spend far too much time with screen media. There's no question about that, and they don't do as well academically and socially as their peers. But for a lot of kids, they still spend plenty of time outdoors and plenty of time.
That's good to hear. Heather Kerkorian is at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, Mary.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I've been listening to your program, and I'm fascinated, although I was driving, so couldn't call in. But I also graduated in early childhood from University of Wisconsin way back when. But I wanted to quickly, and I know you're running short of time, tell you that there are some things that are really interesting that could really put some light on all of this. One is a book called Children of the Cyclops, and that has to do with television. But the author, and I can't remember his name because I'm driving, or was driving, that it talks about how it is not the content so much that we need to be concerned about with media. It is actually the green flickering light of computers and television, and what that it's actually rewiring the brain. And as we know, we have all kinds of problems associated with learning and focusing, and with children nowadays in the school, they don't seem to have the focus that they used to. And so this might shed some light in terms of the research. Also, there's a field in psychology called neurofeedback, which originated out of biofeedback, which they're doing a lot of work actually with computers on developing new kinds of wiring of the brain of children that cannot focus, that are out of control, all kinds of things where they're studying the states of consciousness that we can go into.
Interesting, Lisa.
I actually have not myself heard of that book, and so I'll certainly check it out. I want to say, though, that the rewiring the brain phrase comes up a lot, and it's important to understand that our brains are being rewired all the time in some ways, but certainly when you're young children, no matter what you're interacting with, it's certainly changing your brain. You know, new connections are being formed, other ones are being
pruned. You know, we were talking about this very issue yesterday with the chair of the Department of Biology at Columbia, and he commented that not enough attention has been paid to the chemistry of the brain. People continue to talk about wiring and synapses, but not enough attention on the chemicals that are operating within the brain. So perhaps it is, in fact, a combination of all of these things that we're just not there yet. We are hoping to be there before too long, but we're not there yet. One last comment from an emailer in Mayfield Heights, Ohio. Has there been any study on the difference in the preparation levels of children with and without the electronics when they begin school and as they progress? And that is exactly what's needed.
We need so much more research. it's a barren field out there on a lot of these.
And things. It will come. Lisa Guernsey, she's the author of Screen Time, How Electronic Media from Baby Videos to Educational Software Affects Your Young Child. Ben Worthen is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. His article appeared in yesterday's edition. Liz Pearl with Common Sense Media. Heather Kerkorian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you all for a fascinating show. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurov-Livker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble.